Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Trauma Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Britt Frank, a trauma specialist who is a somatic experiencing practitioner and is trained in internal family systems. She's also an award-winning adjunct professor at the University of Kansas and has taught classes on ethics, addiction, and social work practice. Her first book, The Science of Stuck, will be released in March of 2022. Thank you so much for joining me, Britt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I'd love it if we could start by just kind of disclosing what the biggest myth you see floating around the healing and wellness world is.
Sure. And, you know, with the pandemic and even with shows like Ted Lasso, it's a really good time to be able to talk about mental health. It's been normalized to talk about mental health, but we're not talking about the myths. And because it's so trendy, it's so important to really start out by dismantling what mental health is not. So the biggest thing I want to share, if nothing else, mental health is not a mental process. It shouldn't be called mental health because we think it's all in my mind. It's all in my head. If I just thought better, or if I worked harder at my thought life, mental health is a physical process. So if nothing else, I always like to start with that. Mental health is not about what's in your mind. Mental health is about what is in your body. And if we miss that, then we miss the boat, and then people end up blaming themselves and shaming themselves. And, oh, it's not working for me. I did not know this about mental health until way later in my process. But mental health is a physical process, period.
I love that you say that, too, because I know I've been guilty of trying to think my way through mental health, right? If I read enough, if I study enough, if I talk enough, I'm gonna make my way through this, and integrating, like reminding us and grounding us in the fact that like mental health is a physical process is just a fantastic place to begin. So why can't I think my way through my trauma?
I wish we could. I mean, I like living in my head. So knowing that we have bodies is really important. You can't think your way out of trauma because your mind lives inside a physical brain, which is responsible for a lot of physiological processes. The logical thinking part of our brain is only one function, and it's not the main function. The main function of our brain is keeping us alive. So the survival functions have been around doing their thing a lot longer than the logical conscious thinking, which is why you can't think your way out of a physical process that's been going on for how many years throughout, you know, generations and evolution. And our survival mechanisms will win over logical thought every single time.
And in the context of trauma, let's talk about some of those survival instincts and some of that body process that you're talking about. Like, My babysitter actually said to me the other day, she's been in therapy for about a year after a traumatic experience. And she said to me something to the effect of like, if you don't pay attention to your body will make you pay attention. And I was like, I'm writing that down. My 21-year-old babysitter, like that was deep. And so that's kind of what I'm talking about. It's like, if mental health is a physical process, what are some of the ways that our body is going to make us pay attention?
Oh, yes. And I like to say unprocessed stories show up as symptoms. So whether we think a story should be traumatic or whether we think something shouldn't be a big deal, our body has its own agenda for a number of reasons, ranging from genetics to the current level of safety to privilege to all of the things. But it's really important to know that your body gets to decide what counts as trauma. So I hear every day from people, I don't know why this bothers me so much. It was the littlest thing. And yet I'm super anxious and my heart is pounding and my palms are sweating and what is wrong with me? And it's like, you don't have a mindset problem. You have a trauma problem. And most of us don't know that trauma isn't about the severity of events. It's about our brain's interpretation of safety versus danger.
And that's such a great context too, because, and I know I've done this where I'm in the middle of trying to disclose and figure something out to my therapist. And then in the next breath, because we're such brilliant people and we have such empathy, we can take different perspectives. So in the next breath, I'm saying, you know, but so many people have it so much worse, right? I'm automatically taking myself out of the trauma Olympics. I'm not even a competitor anymore. I'm trying to negate my experience by acknowledging like how much harder somebody else has it, or how much worse somebody else has it, or this shouldn't have been that bad, right? So why do we do that? Why do we try to talk ourselves out of our own trauma?
There's a degree to which perspective is actually helpful. Having perspective on, you know what, it's true. Some people do have it worse. And yes, it's true that I am in a position where I have resources and relative safety. Perspective means I hold room for my truth and recognize mine is not the only story happening on the planet. Perspective is helpful. Comparison is, if I don't have a level 10 trauma and you have a level 10 trauma, mine doesn't count. So comparison negates perspective, makes room. And it's good to have perspective. Our story is not the only story happening at any given moment. But if comparing our traumas was the standard, only one person on the planet would get to be upset about their stuff. Because I don't have it as bad as that person. Well, that person doesn't have it as bad as, and so on. And then if you follow that all the way down, nobody gets to be upset or have feelings about anything. So perspective, yes. Comparison, no.
And to what you were saying earlier, our bodies are what is deciding kind of how we're integrating our traumatic experiences. So regardless of the level or the severity or the context of our experience, our body is what's determining in that interpretation process whether or not that's going to be a traumatic experience. So it's not really as objective as comparing facts of experiences, right?
Yes. And I like to use digestion as a really good correlate because we know if you eat contaminated food, the likelihood that you're going to puke is pretty high. It's not a given, but it's pretty likely if you eat bad food, you're going to get sick. And you can get sick from something you've eaten a million times. A meal that you've eaten 1,000 times before, for whatever reason, is just not sitting. I may not think a turkey sandwich should give me indigestion, but my digestion is an automatic process in which I have no say. So trauma is sort of like brain indigestion. We know if really intense things like assault or war or environmental disaster, if that happens, the likelihood that we'll have trauma is pretty high. It's not a given, but it's high. And at the same time, we could be traumatized by things that may not seem the turkey sandwich events of life. It may not seem like a big deal that you got into a minor fender bender, but your brain might take that and all of a sudden you're having panic episodes and you don't know why, and your brain is spinning and you go, this was not a big deal. What's the problem? But your brain has indigestion. It exceeded its processing capacity and now you have symptoms.
It's a fantastic comparison in context. I really like that.
Thanks.
Yeah. And it also, you know, in the same way that some people, like I have a friend who has celiac disease and also type 1 diabetes, and like all of these things that are not her fault and that she has no control over, right? That she has genetic predispositions for most of that. Like, so all of that comes into play as well with your brain health, which brain health and mental health are it's all physical health. And so if you have a predisposition genetically and even in epigenetically towards traumatic processing difficulties and trauma in your history, then you're going to be maybe more sensitive to a traumatic event and the integration and digestion, as you say, of that event, right?
Yes. And I like to differentiate trauma versus traumatic event versus trauma inducing events versus trauma response.
More.
I will go back and through all of this. So there are traumatic events that we can all agree count, if you will, as trauma. Again, oppression, enslavement, war, sexual assault, all of these things are inherently, they are traumatic events. So that's a traumatic event. Trauma is an internal process. Trauma is the brain digestion process. So a traumatic event is the things that happen. Trauma is our internal processing of it. Now, a trauma response is how that it gets expressed as panic, as intrusive thoughts, as depression, as whatever it might be, right? So that's a trauma response. And it's really important to know that those are not the same thing. Trauma is not the events. Trauma is the internal physiological process. Traumatic events, war, et cetera. But then there's also trauma-inducing events. And those are the neutral things that we don't think should be traumatic, but for whatever reason, they are trauma-inducing. And that could be marriage, having a baby, getting a promotion, declaring bankruptcy. Good things and bad things can be trauma-inducing. And so that's also important to know.
I love that context. And I've had that kind of experience, right? So, and the discernment, I'm trying to think of like a general broad example of, but you can have a traumatic experience. In fact, I've had this. So I had a traumatic experience. Didn't realize it was a traumatic experience at the time, right? Like that's not how I mentally processed it. I processed it as a bad day. I was like, that sucked, right? And then, you know, talk to people about it. And I was like, okay, that's over. Years later, the way that my body processed that and the fact that I had trauma, I had a trauma response to a stimulus related to the trauma experience 7 years ago, right? And was very surprised. I was like, wow, huh. And because of everything that I know now, and because of all the experiences I've had in the last, you know, 15 years, I was like, oh, I recognize what this is and I know what's going on. I need to get some help to kind of pick this apart and help my digestion as you've helped the integration of that experience and that event. So I love that you kind of piece that apart for people, because it can be really confusing, as I'm sure you've seen, when people come in and they say, for instance, like I'm sweaty and shaking and I'm afraid to go outside and I don't know why. I don't understand. It feels like it's come out of nowhere. I'm having all these symptoms and I don't know what it's related to.
I'm so glad you named that, because I can tie some of my things back to events, but it's really often that there legitimately is not a conscious cognitive memory of what this particular symptom is tied to. And that is okay. So another thing I really like to hammer is you do not need to know why a symptom is there for it to heal or to calm down significantly. Is it nice to know our stories? Sure, sometimes. But what's nice about trauma work, real biological, physiological based trauma work, it doesn't require memory of the past, understanding of what led to what led to what. And you can work with the body to provide a sense of safety without knowing the story. So safety can exist without story. And that's incredibly good news. I've blocked out a whole lot of my childhood. I've done hypno and I've done all of these, let me go back and try to find it. And it doesn't work. It didn't work for me. And often it doesn't work to go hunting for memories. But if you start with what's happening now, how do I train my body to recognize safety? You don't need the story. Thank goodness. I don't want to remember all my stories anyway. So it's wonderful news to know stories are not important.
That is wonderful news. And actually, I've been talking to a couple of experts this week about the role of the hippocampus and how in certain situations, it's not that you are missing the memories, it's that the memory was never actually made, right? So any effort to go back and retrieve it is kind of useless because the memory was never formed. I'm not saying it was useless for you to do that. I'm just in certain situations, the memories aren't made, but which can be an incredibly frustrating experience as well, because you're like, if I could just remember, and to bridge on what you said as well, even if you do know the story, and I've found this to be true in my case, even if you do know the story and you are clear, you actually don't have to disclose or talk about it in order to heal and integrate it, right?
It's so good to know. And when I said stories aren't important, I'm not minimizing the impact of the
events. Right, of course.
But it's not essential or necessary to know them. And a lot of people get traumatized in therapy by retelling their trauma story. And so when a brand new therapist that you don't know says to you, tell me about what brings you in to see me, and now you're retelling this narrative, it's really detrimental to your process. And that's not your fault. A trauma-informed therapist would say, I haven't earned the right to hear your story yet, so I actually want you to hang on to it. We may get to it, we may not need to get to it, but you certainly don't have to share it until if and when you want to or feel safe. Consent in the therapy room is not talked about. And it's so important to know that consent matters as much in the therapy room as it does in a bedroom. It's that intimate and it's that important.
I'm really glad that you said that. And that's actually why I brought it up, because I feel like, you know, obviously there's a ton of shame and stigma around trauma and a lot of things, but I think what keeps people from going to therapy or seeking help or wanting to talk about it is that they feel like they have to, or they feel like they're going to be forced to in some kind of old models. And a lot of, you know, there are some therapists who still rely on like, let's talk through it. You're going to have to relive the whole thing. And it's just what we know now is that it's just not necessary. You can, and you should, if you want to, and you feel safe and that trust is there and that security is there, but in the relationship between you and whoever you're working with, but you don't have to.
Right. And it's also not helpful or healing to tell a trauma story in chronological order. So if I start telling my story from start to finish, I'm going to be I've told my trauma stories. I can sit here and spill out really horrible things and I'm not feeling it. I'm just telling you, then this happened and then this happened and then this happened. Telling a story chronologically can actually further dissociate you from it.
Right.
So telling a story in the presence of a safe witness is healing, if it's done in a slow, digestible way in bite-sized pieces. So when I have people share stories or when I invite them to and they consent, we actually skip around the timeline. And that's a technique from somatic experiencing, from Dr. Peter Levine's work, because jumping around the timeline allows you to not get lost in the narrative. You're consciously thinking, oh wait, what happened after that? What happened 2 days before that? And it's a really useful thing. Chronological storytelling, not helpful for trauma.
In general, even in like in TV shows, movies, nobody wants to hear chronological storytelling.
It's true. And telling our stories got us better. We wouldn't need therapists. I know, and I'm sure you know, how to go out with your friends and tell the story of the things that happened. We have friends for that. And we have, hopefully some people have safe, supportive family members for that. So a trauma therapist should not be having you rehash your stories from start to finish ever.
So your new book is called The Science of Stuck. So I would love if you could tell me, like, what does stuck mean to you in the context of trauma?
So the book is called The Science of Stuck because it was really important to me that it was not just my ideas, but that it was a research-based. And, you know, we all have a stack of self-help books on our nightstand and, you know, wherever. And it's hard to figure out what's important from which ones. So I wrote The Science of Stuck because I needed just a really quick Cliff's Notes guide. So each chapter is, here's what the best trauma-informed research, in my opinion, says about addiction. Here's what the best, you know, most cutting-edge minds in the fields of relationships and eating and family dynamics. So you don't need to get a PhD in whatever. It's like, here are the top-level ideas and here are the bottom lines. You can try this, you can do this, you cannot do this. So I really wanted to condense all of those books into one. And of course, I snuck in a few of my own theories in there too.
Of course. I love that because I don't think there's a more overwhelming position than to be at the beginning of your trauma journey, right? And to look at the volume of, I mean, heck, I'm the co-host of a trauma conference. I know the volume of resources available. And it can be incredibly intimidating and overwhelming. Like, what should I do? And what applies to me, my scenario, my situation? And I don't think you can go really too wrong with too many of the tools. It's just a matter of like, there can be the best practice and the best path that's going to help you.
I like calling it the book, you know, it's a speedboat around self-help island. So we're not dropping. And I love plunging into the abyss and getting into, you know, the mud of all of the things. But if you're just starting out, or if you've done a lot of things and now you feel stuck, meaning I know what I'm supposed to do and I'm not doing it. Like at this point, I have the information, but I'm not making the changes. There's only two logical reasons. One, I just suck. Or two, there's a piece of information that's missing. And spoiler alert, you don't suck. There's a big piece of information that's missing if you know what to do and you're not doing it. And that missing piece is trauma in the body. And so that, you know, the book is to fill in the gaps in a really easy to digest way. It's not a deep plunge. It's just, here are the bottom lines that you need.
And I, you know, even the titling, The Science of Stuck, it's, I can relate to that a lot because when you've come to terms with the fact that you might've had a traumatic experience or you're working through some trauma, it feels very stuck. That's literally how it feels. You feel paralyzed. It's, I can't move forward. I'm having trouble even, you know, I have friends and family who, once they come to that realization, like they can't even navigate an insurance website to find a therapist. Like you're literally, there's that feeling of like paralysis, and there's a lot of judgment from the people around you of like, get help, you know, like move through it. Accusations of being unmotivated or lazy or not wanting to get better, right?
So I'm going to speak to lazy and motivated, because again, these are two very, lazy is a moral judgment. It, and I have this in the book, the word lazy comes from like 1500s middle low German, meaning feeble. And what happens in our brains and bodies when we're stuck, when we're not feeling able to do or mobilize, it's not because we're feeble. It's because our brains have switched into a survival mechanism, one of which is shutdown or freeze, you know, fight, flight, and freeze. Lazy is absolutely a moral judgment, not a physiological reality. And as far as motivation, because there's so much motive, just get motivated. Just, we're never unmotivated. And that's the big thing. Our brains are 100% of the time, they are motivated. They are either motivated to survive a real or perceived threat, or they are motivated to mobilize in a direction of our choosing. But unmotivated is a myth. If we're going back to what are the mental health myths, exactly. There's no such thing as being unmotivated. There's being motivated by survival or motivated by choice. That's it. Those are your two paths. But if you don't know this one, you're just going to think it's you. Oh, I'm lazy. No, you're not. That's not physically, that's not a thing. I'm unmotivated. No, you're not. You're just not motivated in the direction you want to be going in. And we can help your brain switch tracks. But if you don't know that, you don't know that.
Absolutely. And because I know that you are versed in internal family systems and IFS work, it's like if you're feeling stuck, what is the purpose of the part that's got you stuck, right? Like I'm always like, all right, what are you trying to protect me from? Right. I'm always like, what is this in service of? What is this part trying to protect me from?
And I love that you segued this into the idea of parts, because we do another mental health myth is that we have this one thing called a mind or a personality, and it's just this one thing. And I am either all of this or all of that. And what we know is our psyches are very, every complex system is made of multiple parts, from plants to animals to our physical bodies, right? So we have parts that want to do things like starting a business or getting a relationship working or whatever. But we have other parts of us, and their job is to stand at, you know, the castle doors and fight off the dragons. And those might be real or imagined. But starting with the assumption we have protective parts, and what if we treated every mental health symptom as an effort to protect rather than a character defect or something that has gone wrong? Like, what's going right about this? What makes sense to my body about why this is happening? And if you don't know why, that's okay. But if you start with the assumption that we have parts of us that will stop at nothing to protect us, even if it means hurting us or sabotaging us, that changes the entire story. It's, oh, I have protective parts. What do these parts need in order to feel safe or safer or a little bit less threatened rather than what's wrong with me?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I've had to remind some people in my life that when someone else is experiencing kind of that stuckness, that they're lucky because they don't understand and haven't experienced how much energy it requires to actually feel stuck or paralyzed or like what looks like a relaxing, like this person isn't able to leave their room and watches a lot of TV. And I was like, looks relaxing from your perspective. Guess what's going on actually? There's a ton of energy being expended on that kind of like homeostasis and maintaining that protection. There is so much. It's like all the, like when a computer is running a bunch of programs in the background and the fan is running and it's really loud and you're like, gosh, I've really got to shut some systems down in order for this to move more efficiently and for this computer, for the temperature of the computer to go down and for the systems to work better. Some of this stuff's got to be, some of these programs need to be quit.
If you hold a beach ball underwater, like think of the energy it takes to hold that ball down. And so there's laziness is not even a factor. It, like you said, it takes a lot of energy to do nothing. And you're going to hold that beach ball underwater, and then eventually it's going to pop up to the surface. And we name that as bipolar. And often bipolar is a trauma response as a result of going into extreme shutdown and then compensating in the other direction. Now, that's not saying mental illness isn't real or that meds are important. But knowing the mechanism of depression is a tremendous amount of energy. You know, I would rather us call depression compression because it's a more accurate word to describe it. I have nervous system compression when I'm stuck on my couch. I have nervous system compression when I want to do nothing or I can't seem to get moving. Because if we call it depression, there's all the loaded, you know, just smile, just take a breath, just meditate your way out of it. Take a walk, right? It's like count your blessings, you know, the gratitude thing. But if you call it compression, that's what it actually is your brain going into shutdown to help you survive a perceived lion attack. The language matters. It really matters.
It does. Absolutely. So tell me how all of this kind of your work and how you see it empowering people and restoring choice to their lives.
So I like to say that the opposite of trauma is choice, because if we could have chosen, we would choose to not be traumatized. We would, you know, trauma by definition is our choices have been taken away and now a thing is happening to us. So anytime you're mindful of choices, that's going to go a long way towards healing trauma. Again, people don't know that. They think I'm broken, I'm crazy, I'm lazy. Just knowing that making choices can help calm down your trauma symptoms, because everyone can do that. I might not have a choice about the pandemic. I may not have a choice about what my spouse is up to. I have a choice about which road do I want to take driving home? What food do I want to eat? And when I'm working with people, we break down, when they say I'm stuck, I have no control over anything, we start with the absolute minutia. Where can you make a choice? And then be conscious that you're making a choice. And then people start realizing they have more agency than they thought. And then that compounds. And then all of a sudden their protectors calm down because choice is restored. And to whatever degree you can make a choice, you're going to calm down your trauma symptoms. That's incredibly empowering because you don't need a postgraduate degree or any specialized information. You know, my goal with the people I work with is for them to not need me. Like my goal is to work myself out of a gig so they know. And obviously it's not like, oh, just make a choice and that attack you suffered is just history. It's more nuanced than that. But knowing that these are very simple, I can do these now today things helps a ton. And you see people get their, you know, oh, I can. That idea that maybe this isn't me and maybe it's not all hopeless, that promotes more change and more choice, which begets more. So yes, very passionate about
the practice of kind of reframing your experience on a daily basis of, you know, instead of all of this is out of control, what is in my control? What choices do I have available to me? I know I've experienced that where when a day goes off the rails, right? Like I've got a whole day planned and then one of my kids is sick and then something happens with the house and like it all seems to fall apart and I will make a list of all of the things I can and will do that day, right? It's like, well, I didn't do anything I planned, but here's what I did do. I did change out of my pajamas. I did brush my teeth. I did watch a television show with my kid who had a fever. I did, you know, like here are all of the things that I did and here are all of the ways that I was able to succeed today, even though the whole day went in the toilet.
I love that so much. And you know, a lot of people are quick to minimize. Oh, so I took a shower, big deal. Well, if you're talking about I want to kill myself, taking a shower is a big deal. Everything is a big deal when you're talking about a nervous system that is perceiving a threat. So if all you do is get from your bed to the couch, great. And if, you know, the things that you did do and the things that you didn't do, I didn't harm myself.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Right? I didn't cause intentional damage to property or to people. I get to give myself a big pat on the back and a lot of credit for that. And it's also helpful with choice not to speak in metaphor. This is another thing I'm really passionate about. When you say things like, I'm overwhelmed, I'm drowning, I just, you know, I can't keep my feet, you know, wherever. That is really abstract and that's going to further aggravate the sense of powerlessness. So instead of I'm overwhelmed, it's I have my kids parent-teacher conference and my mother is in the hospital and I need to go visit her. And rather than speaking in abstract, speaking in very specific terms also helps you. Oh yeah, I have some choices here that maybe I hadn't realized.
Absolutely. Yeah, being as specific as you can is helpful. I had a lunch with my spouse yesterday and he was like, how are you doing? I was like, I'm stressed. But then I went into the details of like the level and the reasons. And he was like, I gotta be honest, I'm stressed now. Right. And he's not one to get, you know, flap like that. That's not, he's not, I shouldn't say he's not empathetic, but normally he doesn't take on other people's stresses. He's very good, very self-managed in that way. But he was like, wow, okay. Thank you for sharing. Now I have to manage your stress. Yeah.
Specific, and you're able to communicate both to yourself and to the people around you what's going on, right? I'm overwhelmed doesn't really have a lot of concrete. What does that mean? I don't know what that means. Therefore, I don't know how I can help you. Therefore, you don't know how you can help you. And it's not useful. So speaking in really specific language and using parts language. How are you? Part of me knows I'm okay, and part of me knows I have it pretty good. And there's another part of me that has 25,000 things on her to-do list. And then there's another part of me that's feeling this. And that also helps you access your choice points if you have specific concrete things that we're talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Like yesterday I was talking about how I'm incredibly excited about the work that I do and incredibly grateful and like fired up about the conversations that I have. And also overwhelmed about the volume and the deadlines, right? Like all those both are true. I can be stressed and overwhelmed and overscheduled and all of the things that I had going on yesterday, and also be incredibly grateful and acknowledge my privilege and access and knowledge and joy that's happening minute to minute. Both things can be true.
Right. I don't know where we learned that you can't have, I mean, to me, mental health is the capacity to hold space for multiple truths simultaneously. So there's nowhere in the physiology that says if you're positive, you can't also be negative. That's why I don't like the words positive and negative. It's I'm feeling joy about this. I'm feeling sorrow about this. I'm feeling really competent in this. And I'm feeling like a total mess and incompetent in this. Cool. You're not crazy. Again, there's room for multiple realities within one psyche, which is, again, really good news. You can have all of the feelings and all of the thoughts at once, and that's not something going wrong with you. That's the design.
Absolutely. And the more we practice that in little micro moments and stack them on top of each other, the more that that muscle gets stronger and we're able to rely on ourselves and depend on ourselves to do that in moments when we're needed on our own, like you said, outside of the aid of a skilled therapist. It's like what we're building towards is that I don't only have that relationship as a place of safety and validation, that I can form that within myself.
Yeah, I like to call them doing fire drills because, you know, it's, we talked about this earlier, practice and repetition create habits. And that's a wonderful mechanism because while you're not in a state of overwhelm or shutdown or compression, start practicing going to the things that help your brain feel safe or safer. Whether I say people, places, thoughts, or things that help your brain access safety, practice them every day as fire drills. That way, if a fire breaks out and your brain's alarm goes off, you've already created a pattern of repetition and you know what to do and where to go and to whom you're calling. So you're not in the moment going, oh, I can't remember anything I'm supposed to do in this moment. So fire drills are a great practice for trauma.
Such a great context because, I mean, there's nothing worse than when you or someone you love is having an overwhelming experience of panic or, you know, one of those symptoms of trauma and either you yourself or someone near you is like, calm down, take deep breaths, right? Like the ways that we altruistically and with good intentions try to either help ourselves or help somebody else in the moment, if we haven't practiced it outside of those extreme stimulus, is just extremely frustrating.
So frustrating. And this is a great practice for kids also, as well as if you see a loved one struggling, just naming, okay, you're having a panic episode. will deactivate the charge of some, not all of it, but just naming it will help de-escalate it. I think Dan Siegel said, if you name it, you can tame it, or something along those lines. And it's true. So rather than telling someone, take a deep breath and calm down, you're having a panic episode. Right now, your brain doesn't feel safe. Right now, your amygdala is like shooting panic signals down your spine. There are things happening in your body. You are not crazy. Just that alone, if nothing else. And it works on kids too. Oh, that's, yeah. We do this with kids. You know, we're going to the doctor and you might get a shot and it's going to hurt a little bit. But if we can name the experience, we dial down the intensity of the overwhelm, which is, again, incredibly good practice for trauma responses.
Absolutely. And yeah, I've started that practice with my kids where if they're extremely overwhelmed and, you know, their heart is beating and they're sweating and they're crying and or something of that nature, I always try to separate those, like that, those symptoms, if you will. I don't call them symptoms to them, but like that, the what they're doing, kind of the expression of their feelings from their feelings. And I you know, I'm trying to tell them like, you're having a really big, like, emotional experience right now. Your feelings are really big. They are true. What is happening for you is valid, right? Like, what, however upset you are, and I don't even know, by the way, I should just give context, like, I never even know what they're upset about. Like, they're so upset that we can't reach it, right? So I'm like, this is a really big emotional experience you're having. Whatever feeling you're having is true and valid. I'm not trying to tell you that it's not. However, the what do I usually call it? Like, the volume or the loudness or the just kind of the, you're up to like an 11 right now, right? And so we're gonna go through some things. I'm gonna sit here right here with you as long as it takes. And we're gonna do a couple of things until your body responses calm down a little bit. And then we can talk about what kind of the reasons are that you're so upset. But we always just talk about like the difference between the feeling itself and the volume of the expression of the feeling.
I have a part of me now that's jealous of your kids. I'm like, that's really good parenting. I mean, imagine if we all got told, you're having a really big feeling, super valid. How do we dial it down from an 11 to a 9, and then from a 9 to a 7? Then our thinking brain turns back on, and then we can use all of those wonderful logical thinking cognitive skills. I love that so much. It's brilliant. Yes,
right.
So much.
And I mean, because how many times do adults, our own discomfort around our children's emotions and expression of emotions is what gets caught up, right? And I've seen, you know, I'm not saying they did the best they can, but like sometimes older adults didn't have all the knowledge in the books and the access that I have, right? Or that you and I have. And so it's, you know, if you're upset, you know, it's don't cry, you'll make me cry. Or you're being too emotional, or you're being too dramatic, or pull yourself together, right? Which works for no one. Absolutely zero humans.
It's also not true. Like, over dramatic is not a thing. It's not a biological reality. Now, you can have a mismatched reaction. I might be reacting to a level 11 to a level 2 situation.
Right.
I'm not overreacting. It's just that my brain isn't seeing this. My brain is seeing this or this. So
my brain is misperceiving the level of danger that my body is interpreting from this situation.
Exactly. So overreaction should be called misperception or a misreaction. Or anytime you're reacting higher than a 5 on a 1 to 10, if assuming that you're actually not under threat, it's likely that your brain is not seeing what's happening. It's perceiving something coming or remembering something that happened in the past. We need to know this so we're not gaslighting ourselves. I'm too sensitive. I'm too needy. I'm too emotional. No, you're not. You're actually not. Your brain is doing exactly what it was designed to do. And we know this because you're alive having this conversation. Yay, brain. Now, how do we help it not have to work so hard?
Yeah. And just in case it helps anybody, I'll give a specific instance. So I have a son who's a sixth grader. And a couple of months ago, it was, you know, close to bedtime, which any parent knows that their kids always have their worst emotional outbursts right at bedtime. They save it all up. Or when you're trying to get somewhere at a specific time. But it was right before bedtime. And he was just in a full-on meltdown, sobbing and just inconsolable. And I honestly thought that someone had died. I thought he had just learned that someone had died, a friend of his or something. It was just completely out of sorts. And obviously, like, I had to do a lot of work in my own self-regulation not to get in a panic because I was scared. I was like, what's happened, right? Like, what do we need to do? And so I went through kind of the scenario that we talked about earlier of naming his big emotional reaction and saying, I'm right here with you and we're gonna, how can we, you know, help? And we did some like ice on his wrists and then he took a shower. And like, usually I throw water on things first. Like that's always my, it's like cold water, hot water. Like we just do water first. We're in Florida. What can I tell you? And then once he got calm enough and was able to speak and to talk about what was going on, one of his friends from his elementary school had moved away and he said, I just don't remember the sound of her laugh. Oh. And I just like, I know, don't you just want, I want to burst into tears right now, right? And so we talked, I was like, that's an incredibly loving, tender, wonderful, you know, thought. I know it doesn't feel good right now, but like, you've totally touched my heart and that this is how you're feeling. And that's a natural reaction of loss and you're grieving a friendship. And also like, they lost touch. The way that they were communicating wasn't valid anymore. He had tried to reach out to her and she was gone. And so he was grieving a perceived loss, which would feel like an 11 on the emotional meter for someone who is in their youth and adolescence of processing big emotions. And so just to be able to like make space for that and to validate that and say like, I understand what's going on for you. And I'm sure that that feels really sad. And we're gonna, you know, try and figure out a way to get a hold of her. And I'm really sorry that connection has been lost for you. Right. And so, yeah, it's just being able to have the tools and the context and the language to hold space for somebody having a big emotional response.
I'm really glad. Thank you for sharing that. I know that's an incredibly like personal, tender type of thing, but I'm really glad that you talked about grief, because really underneath every trauma, if you dig down far enough, is unresolved, untended to grief. But you can't get to grief if you're in the middle of a trauma response. So for your kiddo, you are able to access the grief and not make it all about the response. Like if you had just said, take 5 deep breaths and smile and think of 5 things you're happy about, you would have
write your gratitude journal. Like,
yes, right? And I like to say the ultimate goal of trauma work is to access your grief without tripping your body's alarms. It's sort of like you're ducking underneath the laser beams, trying to get to the grief, because once you process the grief, the trauma responses don't need to protect you anymore, because you've been able to contain the weight of your story. And your kiddo, you taught him how to contain the weight of his story, which means he was upset, but not traumatized. You know, I mean, devastated, but not traumatized. Right. Big difference. So the goal is to turn trauma into grief.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And that wasn't necessarily, you know, a trauma example, as you know, I was just trying to give an example of like a big emotional response and then how we talk our kids through it. Right. But had I not been able to hold that context for him, the next time he lost touch with a friend, that could have, you know, turned into, grief experiences and loss and trauma responses around like abandonment. And, you know, I don't want to speculate too far, but like these experiences build on each other and they form stories in our minds, don't they?
And that's the perfect example, what you shared, of a traumatic event that did not result in trauma. You know, that was traumatic. And because you worked with the symptoms and you named the feelings and you accessed the grief, a traumatic event didn't result in a trauma response or embedded trauma. It grieves. It had space. And we are not good as a culture at holding space for grief. We want to shush it away or happy or think positive or be grateful it away. And grief is real and it's important and it's sacred and deserving of space and time.
Absolutely. Well, before I disclose any more personal information, we should probably wrap up. Fred, thank you so much for joining me. If people want to find out more about you and your work, how can they do that?
The best place to find me is on social media. So I'm on Instagram at Britt Frank, BRITTFRANK. And you can find me at scienceofstuck.com.